We're glad to be here with brethren and sisters of Life Precious Faith this morning. And my mother-in-law and I, my sister-wife is elsewhere today, but we're glad to be here. What we have to say this morning is it's more or less, it's exhortational and it's prophetic in nature as well. So we're going to do a couple of different things. Got a couple of stories to tell, if I can remember them. I'm to the age now where I don't remember my stories very well. But anyway, during the first century B.C., there lived a man named Spartacus. And Spartacus became a gladiator in the Roman army. And he and a bunch of his cohorts decided to rebel and get out, so they did. And over a period of the next 3 to 5 years, Spartacus raised an army of about 120,000 men. And they decided they were going to attack the Roman army. And they did so. They defeated the Roman army on a couple of occasions. But on this particular occasion, Spartacus decided that he needed some reinforcements. So he sent a runner back to tell another general that was under his command to bring the army forward. And this runner that he sent had to go 100 miles. So this person, it's recorded in history, this person, this runner, actually ran the entire distance, that 100 miles. When he got there, he delivered Spartacus's message to the subordinate general, and upon finishing the message, he fell dead. And the story goes that he probably had a heart attack from all the energy exerted. The point being that this particular individual had reached the absolute and complete end of his endurance. Now, I've often thought that, especially in these last days, that sometimes I feel like I've reached the limit of my endurance, and I know the rest of you have too, because you deal with problems, you deal with issues. And just life in general, sometimes you get to the point where this is just about all I can handle. So we reach the limit of our endurance. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we feel like we've gone just about as far as we have gone, that we can go, and we've expended the last bit of energy that we have left. And I think these things, for these thoughts, are especially true with life and the truth. And it's mainly because of the narrowness of the covenant guidelines we have to live under. The restrictions that are imposed upon a believer in God's plan and purpose tends to limit certain activities that we can be involved in. Things that cater to the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Things that our basic human nature tends to like. So where we are is someplace else from where the world is. Because it's much easier to allow our instincts to control us rather than controlling our instincts. Let's look at 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, if you will. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We want to read beginning in verse 24. 1 Corinthians 9, 24 through 27. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. How much more do we have to accomplish than they who run for corruptible things? How much more do we have to accomplish than the man who is the runner for Spartacus? Hebrews, the 12th chapter and verse 1 says, let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Let's look at Philippians, the second chapter. Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Do all things without murmurings and disputings, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. So we have an exhortation to hold forth that word of life, that word of truth, regardless of what it takes, regardless of how much energy must be expended. The exhortation is for us to hold forth that word of life, no matter what it takes. There's a correlation here between our endurance, or the limitations of our endurance in the truth, and the strength of our faith. In Matthew, the 13th chapter, and we spoke something of this last Friday night, but in Matthew, the 13th chapter, beginning in verse 3, this has to do with the parable of the sower. And keep in mind, the point we're attempting to make here in this 13th chapter of Matthew has to do with the amount of our faith being in correlation with our ability to endure and to maintain the integrity of the faith. Matthew chapter 13, beginning in verse 3. And he spake many things unto them in parables, saying, Behold, a sower went forth to sow. And when he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. Some fell upon stony places, for they had not much earth, and forthwith they sprang up, because they had no deepness of root or earth. And when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell upon among thorns, and the thorns sprung up and choked them. But other fell into good ground and brought forth fruit, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30-fold. Who hath ears to hear, let him hear. I was about to quote that from Revelation, but who hath ears to hear, let him hear. So then, however well implanted the seed of the truth is in us, it will be openly manifested in our lives. We can endure much more if the truth is firmly and deeply rooted in our minds. Because if it isn't, then the sun will scorch the seed, it will die, the cares of this life will choke because we don't have any depth of root. So the bottom line is, if the truth is firmly implanted in our hearts, then we can endure much more than we think we're capable of enduring. The truth is also nurtured by constant attention to the written word of God. Now, faith requires a motivator, and that motivating force can only be one thing, and that one thing is the anticipation of the fulfillment of the divine plan and purpose of God. If that isn't our motivation, then we might as well go someplace else, because if we aren't looking forward to the kingdom of God and his righteousness being established upon this earth, the glory of God being on the earth as the waters cover the sea, then we're not in the plan and purpose of God. We don't understand. That has to be our ultimate goal, the fulfillment of all the prophecies concerning those things of the kingdom and of the name. Our whole basis of faith is supported by a belief in the promise that God made to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and to David, and they are still a matter of unfulfilled prophecy. We know we live in the last days of Gentile times, and in the Conway Ecclesia, Brother Darrell does a very good job of keeping us up abreast of the signs of the times. Virtually every time it's his turn to speak, he has something very interesting to say, because he is the watchman. He knows what's going on, and he keeps us well informed of the signs of the times and the things that are happening round about us today. If you will, concerning the signs of the times, we're changing gears now, in case you didn't notice. Let's go to the 12th chapter of Daniel. Daniel chapter 12. I'm going to read the first four verses. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time, to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book of life. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn away to righteousness as the stars, turn many to the righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Incidentally, we were talking in Sunday school class about how forever and ever is how long these things are going to last. When you read in the Hebrew, the word is olam, forever. And when it's in Daniel, it's the olam of the olams. Olam being a hidden period, and a hidden period. And when Daniel says the olam of the olams are forever and ever, it's the olam of the olam. That is, a hidden period divided into smaller hidden periods. But they do have a terminating point. During this period that Daniel is prophesying concerning here is a period of increased knowledge, with people running to and fro in the earth. It's a time when the wicked shall do wickedly, but they shall understand not. We're also told that the wise shall understand. They shall understand that it's during this time of knowledge that Michael, that is, who like God, shall stand up. And those wise ones shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. Now, concerning this time period of increased knowledge in the earth, that's a sign of the time. We can look all around us today and we can see that knowledge has, in the last 150 years, knowledge has increased dramatically. We know things today that 150 years ago we didn't even know existed. But we can actually go back further than that, and this is one of the stories, and I hope I remember all this one. Once upon a time, there was a fellow named Archimedes. Probably all know who Archimedes was. He lived about 200 years B.C. He was a scientist slash inventor, but more than anything else, Archimedes was a mathematician. And Archimedes expanded upon things that some other mathematicians actually did, like Pythagoras. You know, he did the hypotenuse thing. Some of the squares of the legs are equal to the square of the root, or something of that nature. But anyway, he, Pythagoras, invented the a way to determine the unknown in a triangle. But this person, Archimedes, more than anything else, he was in fact a mathematician, and he took all this information that he had, that was on hand, and he elaborated upon it, he expanded upon it, and he came up with some things that heretofore had not been known. For instance, what he did more than anything else was he devised a formula by which you could determine the volume, say, of said triangle, squares, circles, duodecagons, trapezoids, and all these different type of figures. So he devised a method to figure out what the volume of those things are. And Archimedes wrote three books. Two of them survived. One of them got lost. And what Archimedes wrote about was pretty elementary as far as what we know about math today. But what was the contents of that third book was something, it was pretty dramatic. Anyway, this book, this third book that Archimedes wrote, got lost, and then in 1931, it was rediscovered, but not in the same condition in which it was written. Sometime during the Dark Ages, there was this monk who lived in a chapel in Constantinople, and he was digging around through the chapel one day looking for some parchment that he could write on, because he was going to write a prayer book and paint some pictures in it. So he found this book that was about like this. He cut the pages in half, folded them over, and sewed them together to make his little prayer book. But before he did that, it had a bunch of ink, a bunch of writing and stuff on it. So he took some sort of solution that he had, and he washed all the ink off his parchment. And anyway, he wrote this little prayer book. And shortly after it was discovered in 1931, there was the outbreak of the Second World War, and the thing was lost again. And it didn't show up until 1992. Well, in 1992, some people got to looking at this thing, and they said, you know, there's something written here underneath this. If you look at this just right, you'll see that something else is there. So it was taken to the British Museum, and scientists, archaeologists began to work on this piece of paper to see what was written under there. Well, it turns out it's the third work of Archimedes, and it's called The Method. And in this book, he totally and completely explains about calculus. So the issue is, the point is, that Archimedes discovered calculus 200 years B.C. We think it was done by Isaac Newton 1500 A.D. So 1700 to 1800 years before Isaac Newton was born, Archimedes discovered calculus. And the scientific world today is completely on its ear. This is the most wonderful thing that could ever have happened. And the reason is, the scientific community all together are saying that if mankind had known about calculus 1,500 years before Isaac Newton, we would be so far advanced today that it would be pathetic, because everything in the scientific community, all aeronautic engineering, physics, architecture, all types of engineering are all based on calculus. If we didn't have calculus, we would have never got to the moon. We would never got off the ground. So what the scientific community is saying, that where would we have been if we had known this information 500, 600, 700 years earlier? So the point is that man, that this increase in knowledge would have been much earlier than it was. And as far as I'm concerned, this was providential hand of God directing the affairs of men, because this bit of information that would have advanced man 400, 500, 600 years was actually hidden until what we know as the time of the end. It would be a time of the end when knowledge shall be increased. So we have the promise of shining as the brightness of the firmament if we remain steadfast, especially in this period described as a time of increased knowledge. Now, in that same 12th chapter of Daniel, there are several time periods given, and this time period that we're living in here is described as a time when knowledge would be increased. And in this time in which we live, knowledge has never been this far advanced. So we're living in a period when knowledge would be increased. And Daniel 12 says during that period, certain other things were going to happen. And if you look at the latter verses of the 12th chapter of Daniel, it talks about 1260 years, 1290 years, and 1335 years, and I'm sure all of you are thoroughly and completely familiar with that. But if we begin our calculations using traditional numbers, we come short by several years, because it all happened in 1992. But if we begin our calculations of this time when knowledge would be increased that Daniel speaks of here in chapter 12, if we calculate that period from the time that Belshazzar saw the handwriting on the wall, we come up with some different numbers. Belshazzar saw the handwriting on the wall October the 10th, 539 B.C. October the 10th, 539 B.C. So if we take that 2,520 years and subtract 539 from it, comes up 1981. And then we turn right around and take that 75 years from Daniel the 12th chapter there and add that in there. Comes up to 2056. Now, look at verse 13, Daniel chapter 12. It says, "Go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days." So what is it? What is Daniel's lot? When is he going to stand in his lot? Will Daniel stand in his lot when he's resurrected to stand before the judgment seat of Christ? I don't think so. I think Daniel standing in his lot will be when he has inherited the things that were promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because that's his lot. Standing in the resurrection is not. Receiving the promises and the fulfillment of God's promise through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would be standing in his lot. Okay. So, in my opinion, when Daniel stands in his lot would be 40 years earlier than that. Because when Christ returns to the earth, there's going to be the resurrection, the judgment, the destruction of the Gogian invader, the destruction of the beast and the kings. And all this is going to take time. And the kingdom isn't going to be established during that early period. It's going to be established at the end of these destructive battles. And if we allow 40 years for that particular period, and then we subtract that 40 from 2056. It comes up to 2016. Also, there's a year, 1 year discrepancy there from changing from BC to AD. So you subtract another year from that and you've got 2015. So, if then this gives us any kind of indication as to what period of time that we're actually living in, then here again, we have the promise of shining as the brightness of the firmament if we remain steadfast and maintain the integrity of the faith and endure right up till the end, no matter how bad things get. In conclusion, the most anticipated words of any exhortation, Galatians chapter 6. "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone, and not in another. For every man shall bear his own burden. Let him that is taught in the word communicate unto him that teacheth in all good things. Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap, if we faint not." So that's the purpose. That's the point. That's why we're here. That's why we believe the things that we believe. And that's why we're able to endure, because we know that we shall reap if we faint not.